This Week in Retronauts, time makes fools of us all once again. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, but you probably knew that because you're cool and you listen to the show on a regular basis, and so you recognize my voice. Well, great. I appreciate that. Thank you. We are here, and when I say we, who else do I mean? There's another American here in the podcast recording zone with me.
I am an American. I'm Critical Kate Willard, and I was on the previous episode as well.
That is correct. And also a non-American.
Hello, I'm Stuart Jipp, and you probably knew that already because I went around your house and it was kind of weird and uncomfortable.
I mean, the part where you just like slept on the sofa for a week was a little strange, but...
You wouldn't let me in the bed, Jeremy.
That's just parasocial relationships in the year 2025.
Right, a pair of crazy social relationships.
That's right. Hi, everyone. This is episode 736 of Retronauts. And this is the second part of the second chapter of the Metroidvania Book Club. That is a lot of numbers to distinguish this episode. Now, you may recall that last time we recorded one of these, which was quite a while back, Chris Sims was part of the conversation, but he had something come up at the last minute. However, Chris does have next pick of the Metroidvania Book Club topic, and I will announce that at the end of this episode. That's right, you have to listen to all of this before you get to know what's next. So please enjoy the next 90 to 120 minutes of levity, banter, and... Well, I'm going to be doing some wailing, not like angry or complaining wailing. Just this game broke me. It made me ask a lot of questions about myself and realize some things I didn't want to face up to. So we'll talk about that. And the game in question is The Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown.
I'm convinced that if we'd gone with my original plan of doing it as three episodes, that we would have lost one more person.
It just would have been a gradual,
I'm going to record the secret fourth episode. I'm going to skip the third episode and record the fourth episode where it's just me. I'm the only one talking about it.
All right. This is all very exciting news. New frontiers of Retronauts. After all these years, nearly 20 at this point, we can still surprise you, the listener, with our shenanigans.
Nearly 20 years. Good God. We should stop.
Please, no. I need to pay my mortgage. I need to continue creating content that helps me pay my bills. So here we are in the Content Factory, and... I have to admit, I was very stressed out about this whole episode because I had a really difficult time with this game. And I feel like, you know, people are subscribing to Retronauts. This is a patron-exclusive episode. People are paying to hear this conversation. And I feel like, what happens if I don't bring my best? But it turns out that my best just... is not that great when it comes to this style of game. This is not a Jeremy Parrish game. And I felt bad about that for a while, and then I realized, you know what, that's okay. Because that doesn't mean it's a bad game. It doesn't mean other people can't enjoy it. It just means it's not the thing for me. And there's a whole vast panoply of entertainment out there that I can actually contend with and play competently. And I'm excited to play more of those. But this is not one of those. And so I'm going to rely on the two of you to tell me what this game was about. Because I, like I said, had a rough time with it. I did not finish this game. I really wanted to. But good God, it's just, it's not, it's not compatible with my state of existence at the moment is mainly the problem.
You may remember in the previous episode I did whinge about this game quite a lot, and for that I did genuinely feel some remorse. I thought that wasn't very nice of me. I shouldn't have been so down on the game that I haven't finished yet. And I have now finished it. I finished it today because this sort of sprung up and I was like, oh, I suppose I should finish that Prince of Persia game. Now, previously, I had said how I don't like adjusting the difficulty so on a macro sort of level because I feel like the game should be balanced better. And I, frankly, just held my hands up and I said, you know what? I'm just going to do it because I don't think I'll get through this game otherwise. I don't think I'll A, have time, or B, have the patience. So I made some changes. I made it so that you can parry from any direction because that's an option that they put in. Doesn't mean you have to be facing the enemy. And I made some other changes. I can't remember what they were, but the game overall became significantly easier. And I have to admit, once I had done that, I was able to actually kind of engage with it and go like, no, you know what? This is really good. This is really, really well made and a very good example of what it is. There are things about it that bothered me, but I think I may have just been salty that I wasn't good enough at it, you know? Having self-finished it and seen all the cool stuff that is in there, I feel much more positive about it. And I feel like if I were to go back to it, I would be able to play it and enjoy the entire thing, you know? Not sure when I'm going to be doing that, but I might, you know.
It's a very long game, so yeah, that's a commitment.
Yeah,
I feel like we as gamers or whatever you want to call us, need to like kind of get over the whole shame of like adjusting the difficulty beyond normal. Like I got over it a long time ago. Like when I started playing this, I didn't even start playing on normal. I went into the options right away, and that's part of what I loved about the game was seeing the options right away, how customizable it was. And so I tuned it immediately, and that's why I think in part that I loved it. Like, for me, this is a game where my only nitpicks were what I mentioned last time, which was mostly just the story stuff, like everything about how the game is played. I pretty much loved it, and I was surprised when I suggested it, when we started discussing it. I thought that this was going to be like universally beloved, and I was surprised that it ended up being an example of how different people want different things out of their Metroidvanias. Mm. Like, you know, if we ever, when we inevitably one day get to like Hollow Knight, I expect that one I'm probably going to be complaining quite a bit. But like, I thought this one was going to be the one where like, yeah, everyone like that is a good, and you know, we're learning things about ourselves.
Yeah, if anyone ever suggests Hollow Knight, I'm going to throw them through a window.
Yeah,
I love that game, but no.
I don't see myself doing that. I think this is an exceptionally well-made game. They put some budget into it, which you never see really with a Metroidvania game. They tend to be either like a big publisher just kind of says, okay, guy, you want to make a Metroidvania? Here's $10 and some string. Go for it. Or else it's an indie team, you know, pouring years of their lives into something that may or may not get noticed. And having a major publisher like Ubisoft just clearly put, you know, a whole game's budget into something like this is remarkable. And I do feel like that is kind of where it trips itself up, because I feel like they felt like, you know, we're making a proper game out of this, so it has to have everything in it. All the things that have ever been created must be represented in this one video game. And I feel like there's really just, for me, too much. I just can't, like, it's a lot. It's a lot.
I feel like, and yeah, sorry.
I had my phase of, like, really enjoying vast games, probably like 10, 15, 20 years ago, and really difficult games like 30 years ago. But now I'm old and slow and very, very busy and very forgetful. So I have no reflexes anymore and no memory. So a game that demands you have great reflexes and remember a lot of controls and a lot of different situational actions for different enemies, That's asking too much of this old man. Please let me just go sit on my porch and drink lemonade and reminisce about, you know, simple games like Battletoads. Yeah. Friendly, easy games.
I think the only issues I ended up with this with in the end of this game were because it always goes big, and there are times when I feel like it could have gone less big. But as Kate says, I do wish that I had just tuned the difficulty at the beginning. In a sense, it's like the game is not, it doesn't say straight up, this is what will happen if you select this option. You know, you have like a guided mode or a freeform mode, and I had the freeform mode on because I don't, you know, I wanted to explore. I have it on normal because, not because of, oh, big, tough, best at games, you know? It's just, I thought it would be fine. I don't usually have much trouble with games on normal, and I did. But had I played it either on easy or just made these minor tweaks, I think I would have had almost no issue. And I'm kind of sad that I didn't. But also, I kind of feel like maybe they should have made normal mode the hard mode, you know, and easy mode the normal mode. That's pretty
that's
much
how
it.
That's how I felt about Metroid Dread, frankly.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They didn't even have an easy mode until, like, they patched it in, like, a year later or something like that, and it's like,
oh, sounds like it's time for me to finally play that.
Right. But I might go back and replay it now that they have an easy mode.
So I will say about Lost Crown that one thing I admire about the game is that I feel like it does make itself, it states its intentions pretty clearly in the prologue. That introductory section where you're just kind of, you know, running in a straight line and a bunch of dudes fight you and then there's a boss, like that kind of puts all the cards on the table. It says, look, if you play on normal, you are going to need to parry these guys really, really effectively. They're going to gang up on you. You have to learn to manage crowds. You have to learn the proper timing. You have to really get a handle on just the way combat works. And now there's a boss, and he's got things you can't even parry. Like, you have to learn how to evade his attacks and learn how to counter them. And, yeah, I played on normal up until I got to that boss and then said, you know what? It would be really pathetic if I couldn't even get past the opening prologue boss for this game, and I'm supposed to make a podcast about it, so I tuned it way the hell down. But really the problem, I mean, yeah, like, the parrying and the combat focus was definitely challenging, but the problem that really vexed me with this game was just the sheer size of it. And the fact that the space, like, it just feels kind of unmanageable in a way. I mean, there are fast travel points, but they're pretty few and far between. And unlike a lot of Metroidvania-style games, this one is not really all that linear. There's like a sequence of events that you need to complete, and it is going to be fairly mandatory that you acquire certain abilities to cross, you know, certain gates. But up until you kind of hit those barriers, there's actually a lot of different ways you can go. And the game also kind of gives you enough rope to hang yourself with. So you'll be like, well, I think maybe I should go this way. And you can go quite a distance in a certain direction before you hit a dead end, at which point you realize, oh, I don't have the ability that I need. And then you have to backtrack. And, you know, there will be points where it's like, oh, well, you want to get to, you know, the underground prison of sand? Well, to do that, you need to go up to the top of the world and fight around in the archive. But you probably need to take a couple of detours to other points first. And just space traversal is really time consuming. And I feel like that's not normally a bad thing for me, but there's something about the repetition of the visual design, the ambiguity of some of the spaces. I don't know. It just felt like every time I kind of realized, oh, I'm going to need to hoof it way across the map, It didn't feel like, I'm getting to explore new spaces. It's more like, oh, I can't explore this new space. Now I have to backtrack, and there's going to be all these guys fighting me, and I have to deal with all the battles and all the puzzles and all the platforming just to get to a new section. And I don't want to spend an hour doing that just to get to a new meaty section. So it actually became kind of discouraging after a while. Maybe I just don't understand how the world is laid out or something.
To be
but, you know, as the kind of person who likes to just say, I want to see what's over here in a video game. I like when I look in a place and going over into an unexpected area yields rewards. But in a lot of cases, it was just like, oops, I did the wrong thing. Well, now back to the main path. And
to be
brace up for it.
Yeah, it's a mechanic in the game that I only figured out today, despite the fact it was there since the beginning. And this is hands held up. This is my error. The little girl whose name is escaping me right now, who sells you the when you buy maps from her, she's in each area. She's back in the hub, the Haven, and she'll sell you treasure maps. And I was ignoring them because I was like, well, you know, I don't need that. That's like a you know. But then I thought, no, I'm going to buy these treasure maps. And it turns out that having icons on the map that show you where the treasures are also kind of effectively shows you where treasures are, and that's the main path. That's a very useful thing to gather, because you can go, oh, okay, so the fact that that's a dead end with one of those X's at the end means it's probably not the way forward, so I'll just keep going around here. And I kind of wish I'd done it earlier on. I stymied myself. I stymied bad. I'm always stymieing myself, you know?
Yeah, to be honest, in Metroidvanias in general, I don't like regenerating enemies because that always feels like it discourages me from going back through areas like you're saying. Like this isn't the first game where I felt that way about it, so I just kind of put up with it. But I kind of wish that we had more Metroidvanias where I could tell where I've already explored because of the fact that there are, like, no enemies. Like, oh, I killed them all. I've been here before, you know? Like, why don't we see that happen more often?
Well, I think in this case, you need the respawning enemies because there's an economy, there are shops. There are things you can buy that are non-obligatory, that are, you know, consumable. So I think if enemies didn't respawn, then it would be much harder to guarantee that you had the money you needed when you need it. So I can kind of see why they did that. But I really like the way, you know, like the original Legend of Zelda did respawning, which is that you clear out a room, and that room stays cleared out for a little while, for like a minute or two, which in that game is pretty, you know, a pretty good amount of time because it's so compact. And eventually the enemies do respawn. You know, Metroid did that too, some of the Metroid games. Like, I feel like that's a good compromise where it allows you to kind of go back and forth and search around a little bit in an area, a very specific locale, without feeling like, oh, I went through the door and that wasn't where I was supposed to go, and now I have to backtrack and now I have to do all of this all over again. You know, I don't mind enemies respawning after a while. I just wish it wasn't, you know, as soon as you zone out from one room to another in this one. Give it a little bit of a cool down, well, if you don't mind.
I think some enemies, they don't do that with all the enemies, because I know that from today I was trying to get enemies to respawn and they weren't. And I was like, I guess
it's
I have to
never when you want them.
The area entirely. I mean, I say an issue, but something that raises, I think, is in this game you have the respawning enemies, but also if you're not on your game and you mistime a parry or something, even the basic enemies can just chew you up. You can just run past them, you can dash past them, but then you don't get the parry timing down, you know. And that's an issue that to some extent Hollow Knight has as well, but Hollow Knight's once you get the sort of needle upgrades, you are one-shotting the basic enemies, and in this game it's always, I think, a full combo minimum is like one four-hit combo. And that's something I mentioned in the last thing is, like, with fodder enemies, I really need them to just die. You know?
Yeah, I don't mind
on the first run through, but one of my favorite things about a Metroidvania is when you return to an old area and you just chew through everything.
In this game,
I feel like you never get that. That's not saying that's bad necessarily, it's a different type of thing, but I never felt powerful really at any point, you know?
Yeah, you have all these crazy, amazing skills by the end of the game.
Yeah.
Like, you can do everything, bending time, but you know, those little mooks that you had to hit combo at the beginning of the game, you still got to combo them. There are limits to how much you can upgrade, and you know, there's like four different kinds of currency in this game, and some of the currencies, like the Xerxes coins and the Damascus ingots, you know, those are tied to specific upgrades to specific powers, and those are, you know, those are limited. but there's no way to overspend on them. Like, there are 20 Damascus ingots, and there are 20 possible weapon upgrade steps, or, you know, 20 ingots worth of investment you can make in your weapons. So they balanced it exactly. Like, there's no extra, but there's no overage either. But yeah, with cash, you know, if you buy some of the consumable stuff, and I can't remember exactly what's consumable, but there are a few things, you know, just like health upgrades, even, or health refills.
You can upgrade your amulets as well with cash, mm-hmm. to like +1, +2.
Yeah, and there's so many of those things, and they follow the post Skyrim rubric of like, you are getting a +2% buff to some random stat that unless you stack it with something else, you don't really notice an effect. But it's you know, you have to figure out what the best combinations are, mm-hmm. of all these different abilities. It feels like a game that really rewards people who give themselves over to it, like who really, yeah. really just go all in, commit themselves. And I think that's ultimately the problem for me, is that, you know, I just have so many responsibilities, so many things that I'm working on, so many things I've got to deal with in real life, that, you know, it's been this way since the original Demon Souls came out. I wanted to play that and sat down with it for a few hours and realized, like, I'm just like, I've got other things I need to do. I can't commit to this. I'll never be able to, you know, dominate at Fortnite or whatever, because I can't.
You can
I can't
get a
dominate.
Victory Royale, Jeremy.
No, Goku will never be a victor under my control.
You need to get Peter Griffin like me.
I feel like I actually took the opposite approach. Like, I didn't commit to, like, cause like the, I agree as in terms of the bigness of the game, it feels like maybe they were pressured into making a full price game. So they're like, we have to make it super big, which would have overwhelmed me if I knew how big the map was initially. Like, I like bite sized, you know, games, even if it's Metroidvania. But for this one, my approach, rather than committing, like for a bite-sized game, if I know it's going to be 2 or 3 hours, I'm like, I want to sit down and play 2 or 3 hours of this. But for this one, I literally only played like 30 to 16 minutes, 60 minutes an evening, like an hour max. I would basically try to get to the next save point in an hour, and then I'd be like, all right, I feel satisfied for the evening. And my first playthrough, I just stretched it out over like several months of just like playing it bite-sized, literally. I think in part because that's actually how I also play Fortnite, is like, I'm just going to play 2 matches and then, you know, I move on to other stuff. And I've gotten all sorts of battle royale, so I think you can do it, Jeremy.
I tried. Here's the thing: like, when I would sit down with the game, it would take me half an hour just to like get my head, you know, get the muscle memory warmed up again. And by that point, you know, something else comes up, and I have to put it down. You know, a big part of it when we did the first episode, I played and got to the point where you're plunged down the pit and kind of trapped in a prison. And that is the worst place to stop playing, because they take away your map. There's really poor signposting. And I would come back to it every once in a while and be like, okay, I'm going to figure it out this time. And I would just wander around and realize, oh, I'm just wandering through the same places I went last time. This is actually where I landed. So I just went, you know, I backtracked. But I really have trouble kind of finding my way in the extraordinarily samey tunnels of this space. There's so much space, so much volume. I mean, ultimately what I did this morning was I said, I've got to at least get out of here before I can record another episode and, you know, get another power, have a couple of boss fights. So I sat down with just a you know, a map online, and was like, oh, okay, it looks like the room that I'm in is shaped like this part of the map, so that must be where I'm at right now. And eventually I did get through. I, you know, fought the battle and got the cool, like snap to your shadow point power. And, you know, from that point, I started to make some progress. And then I realized once again, oh, I went the wrong direction. Even though it looks like I need to go that way, I actually need to go the other way, and it's going to be a slog. And then I started to go in that direction, did some fast travel, found the fast travel point in that area. And from where I fast traveled, I thought, okay, I should probably go this direction. And that turned out to be incorrect also. So it was just like me running into dead ends and having a rough time. Like the decision to follow the stealth section where you have to avoid the indestructible jailer who will send you hurtling back to the beginning of the area if he catches you, followed by a space where you're dropped into darkness and trapped without a map. Like that's a pretty bold design choice. Like it takes some gumption to do that. Like you've got to say, you're giving your players a lot of credit, I think, to deal with bullshit, which I don't know that I am. I'm capable of that anymore. So yeah. It was, I feel like the rough stuff is really kind of front loaded in this game, and probably from here on out, it's good times, but it's just demoralizing. Honestly, it just makes me feel bad about myself, and that's not why I'm here.
I do think a lot of the hard stuff was front loaded, and the second half is so much more fun because at a certain point the abilities that you gain, they start like stacking on to each other, yeah. Where you can combo these things in some ways to get past puzzles, which is super satisfying. But you don't get that really in the first half. You don't even get a double jump in the first half.
But I think that's kind of cool. I think. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Stuart.
Oh, I was going to say, I feel about the same, that the second half of the game, which I more or less did today, was a lot more fun for me, A, because of the difficulty thing, but also because you do have so much more to work with. It's so much less likely you're going to pass something and find a side path that rewards you with nothing, or with a wall that you can only pass through the other direction, or just some gems, which is the most demoralizing.
And, yes, absolutely. That's the exact word that came to mind when anytime that happened, I was like, ugh. I figured out this incredibly difficult puzzle. I died and died and died, and some gems. I could just go like kill 20 dudes for this.
What factors in for me with that is, and again, I promise you, I actually like this game now, and I like it quite a bit. I'm just getting this out of the way. Is the fact that when I said they always go big when they could have gone small occasionally, I feel like there are vast swathes of this game, usually the side paths that just lead to some gems that I could honestly just do without, and they could maybe use the best of those puzzles to hide things of actual value behind them so that you know when you find a side path that you're going to find something cool at the end of it that's worth getting. Just getting gems for doing like a bunch of double wall jumps, shadow simmer, whatever it's called, warps, past stupid red blocks that fly into the wall and then disappear and kill you if they hit you. And then you have to get back and land on the ground.
Yeah.
If you get all of that and then all you see are four gem clusters, it's like, go to hell, Ubisoft.
Yeah, sometimes those are like Xerxes coins, and then you feel like, oh yeah, this is the good stuff. This is going to get me something. Yeah. But yeah, some gems. Oh, I can buy a map fragment
again. Yeah, but no, again, I like this now. I do. I had a lot of fun with this. I think towards the end, especially, you start seeing some really cool, really novel stuff that I've never seen before. Just one thing I want to mention real quick is the pirate ship area towards the end. There's a frozen in time pirate battle thing with a flying ship. And time has frozen at the point that lightning has struck the ship. So the impassable pain wall is a lightning bolt that's frozen in time. Isn't that just cool? Isn't that just a cool idea?
Yeah.
I thought that was dope.
I skipped ahead and, you know, watched YouTube videos so I would have some clue of what lay ahead. And they do some really cool stuff both in terms of stage design and also like story and combat design with the time travel thing. I was pleasantly surprised by how that element, which is, you know, so integral to Prince of Persia at this point, was incorporated here in kind of new and surprising ways, things I didn't necessarily see coming. And also some like battles where I look at them and I think, how does anyone actually finish this? But Yeah, I wanted to go back and say about the lack of, well, not the lack of a double jump, but the fact that you don't get the double jump until way in the back half of the game.
Yeah,
I respect that. I feel like that is a statement of confidence by the developers, because you know in a Metroidvania, you are going to get a double jump. It's just going to happen. Just, you know, some games just give it to you right out of the gate. Like some of the Castlevanias for DS, I think, it's like the first upgrade you get. So at that point, it's like, why not just let you do that from the start? I guess it's just to kind of give you like a sense of, hey, here's some power-ups. Enjoy. This is what it feels like to get a power-up. But yeah. Here, they were like, no, we have different abilities. We have different powers and skills, and we want you to engage with this game on our terms. And I didn't necessarily enjoy engaging with the game on their terms, but I respect the fact that they just, you know, through a very simple design choice, you know, said, we're not going to give you this mandatory, obligatory power up right away. You're going to learn some other stuff first. And then, you know, once you've got all of that in there, then the most basic, you know, kind of cliched power up you can get in a Metroidvania at this point, like, you'll use that as, you know, to, like an effectiveness multiplier for the things you've already learned. That's pretty good. That's like that's people who you know, sat down and really thought about it, who've played a lot of these games and said, we're going to do something a little different. And I respect that a lot. And it's, you know, as much as I'm kind of I really don't want to sound negative here, because I don't dislike this game. It just, you know, it's just not, it's not compatible with me as a human being, as an entity. I do. You know, well, you know what? I think this is, I would call this the,
a lot of games.
I would call this the Half-Life 2 of Metroidvanias. And what I mean by that is Half-Life 2 is a game that when I play it, I hate every single second of playing Half-Life 2. It is the most miserable, antagonistic game experience. I don't know what it is about that game, but I just hate it so much when I'm playing it. And then I stop playing it and I'm like, I'd really like to play some Half-Life 2. And I don't know what this weird sickness is, but Half-Life 2 does that to me. It's so evocative, and it does so many interesting things in a way that is antagonistic to me personally, that, you know, it's just a miserable, soul-crushing experience to play that game. And yet, when I'm not playing it, all I can think is, I should be playing Half-Life 2. And this is kind of like that. Like, I don't honestly enjoy playing it, but there's so much cool stuff in there, and there is this big world to explore, and that's what I love most of all about video games, is exploring things. That's like the essence of me. That's the one thing that I really want, is to just, like, go and explore and use cool systems to do it. And this has that, but for some reason, when I actually, like, put the controller in my hands, I just want to cry. And it's the weirdest thing. There's something wrong with me, I think, that games do this to me. But, you know, I will say that even if I consider this game like kind of a personal assault on me and everything that I stand for, there is something about it that makes me say, you know what, I'm okay with that. I think, I don't know. I don't get it.
Felt similarly to you the first half, I really did, but sorry to repeat myself, but then when I did tune it more to my personal sort of freedom and taste, I was just like, oh no, this is good, I like this is fun, I'm having a good time. I like the way that the as you say, you get the double jump so late that it's not just like in something like Castlevania Portrait of Ruin, where it's like, oh, there's a platform up on the ceiling, well, obviously I can't get there yet, that's basically a key and a lock, right? In this game, once you get the double jump, you're like, oh, hey, I can air dash in the air and then double jump out of it to hook around onto the other side of a wall. They use that, like, you use the combination of the air dash, the double jump, and the shadow of the Simog thing. If I'm pronouncing that wrong, I genuinely apologize.
I don't know. I played in Farsi, so I don't know how they pronounced it.
Okay. the way it all came together, I was very satisfied with. I felt like they did the work on how their own mechanics kind of function, you know, to create these challenge rooms that felt doable while also being genuinely challenging. And I thought it was nice of them to include in the accessibility options teleporters that will skip you past the most difficult mandatory platforming bits that are like that. Because if you just get to a point where you're like, I'm so over this stupid bit with these stupid sandworms tunneling through these rocks, which is how I got. Yeah. I was so done with that bit. There's like 5 rooms of it. And I was just like, no more. And that's all mandatory, but you turn that on and it's like, no, just fine. Just go to the boss. It's fine. Like, don't worry about it. And does the game put a massive stamp on your save saying you used assist mode? No, it doesn't. You get the achievements, mate. It counts.
Yeah, so, like, I used that a few times and, yeah. You know, I didn't like... Sometimes I would keep, like, trying. Like, this was a weird game where, like, I'm just, like, the first moment I can, like, skip something that seems bullshit, I'll be like, nah, let's do it. But I would actually want to try a few more times, and sometimes I'd actually make it through, and other times I'd be like, no, skipping it.
It's been interesting for me, because it has been quite liberating to let go of, I guess it's not really pride. I like challenging games. I do. The problem is, I suppose, I like challenging 2D games with 2D sprites where you can see the collision points a bit more clearly. I felt a few times this being 2.5D. I'm not really a fan of 2.5D for this reason. It never quite feels tight, you know? I just wrote the Tombi 2 guide. Oh boy, you don't want to know about that forest or the trouble I had with that.
It's been almost 3 decades, and they still haven't quite gotten 2.5D to feel this, as good as 2D.
And this is probably the best 2.5D game that I've played that I can think of.
Even this, like, I didn't really feel like collisions were too difficult, like. I had a good sense of where my character was in the middle of things. It's when combat starts and you start using a lot of abilities that have glow effects, and then your enemies have glow effects, and you know, everyone is just like this series of sparks moving around the screen, and after a while you just kind of lose sight of, like, where are the people? Which of the sparks is mine? Is it that blue spark, or is it this blue spark? And, you know, that's something that's always bothered me about games like this, too, where they take away, you move away from sprites and you get these polygonal and particle effects, and they kind of interfere and obfuscate what's actually happening on screen. And that's always a frustration. I don't think this game is too bad about that, but it definitely did trip me up once in a while. And I feel like, you know, in a game that is so much about frame-specific parrying and that kind of precision, it needs to be a little tighter in that respect. But on the whole, I feel like maybe because the resolution is so high, it's not as mushy and it doesn't feel as vague in terms of polygon edges as, like, you know, some of the stuff on PlayStation or PSP or DS felt.
Try and jump on an enemy in Pandemonium on PS1 and see how well you do there, put it that way. But this is not Pandemonium on PS1, thank God. I liked how, staying on, sorry, on theme with the double jump a little bit, the power-ups that you get later in the game, like there's one you get quite near the end where the chakram, you can then teleport to where you throw it, and that, I thought, was something I hadn't seen before either, that seemed so natural an inclusion in a Metroidvania. I couldn't think of another. I know that there's the Puppet Master thing in, Dawn of Sorrow, but it's so much more than that. It's like
there's something kind of similar in Axiom Verge, but it's not something you see a lot of, for sure.
Oh, that this is, they were showing up my lack of having finished Axiom Verge there, unfortunately. Yeah. See, this is the interesting, fascinating contrast between the beauty of human beings, which is you love Axiom Verge, and I thought it was really, really boring. And I keep thinking, I should go back to that. I bet I'd like that if I could get stuck into it. It seems like everything I should enjoy. Oh, God, you didn't make it, did you?
I mean, there is an Axiom Verge 2 collector's edition back behind me that I did everything except make the game for that.
It's
okay.
Okay.
It's not my game. Thomas Happ.
Well, this might be a bad time for me to reveal that I made Half-Life 2 then.
No, I kind of wondered. The fact that all the scientists look like you, that was kind of a giveaway. Say Gordon Freeman for me.
Gordon Freeman. Well, I don't know what they sound like.
The scientists all have kind of a British accent, actually. Or some of them do.
Rise and shine, Mr. Freeman.
See, wake there you go. Yeah, that's scary.
Smell the ashes.
So anyway, back to Prince of Persia.
Yes.
So I do want to actually talk substantially about the game as opposed to gesticulating vaguely about the things we like or maybe don't like about it.
Yeah,
because it does have a lot of interesting, I feel, kind of unique abilities. I mean, admittedly, I'm not up on my indie Metroidvanias over the past 5-6 years the way that I was before that. But it does a lot of stuff. And like I said, you know, the fact that it gives you the jump, the double jump so late is really kind of front loading these abilities. And these are all, you know, the core abilities that you get as add-ons are all Simurgh feathers. So there's like a giant bird of wisdom in mythology that is integral to the plot and leaves its feathers all over the place. And anytime people get one of those feathers, they're like, I have a cool new power. And that becomes a main point of contention in the story. But in terms of gameplay, it gives you some abilities that you've seen before, and also some abilities that you have not seen before. Like the first power you get is Rush, which, you know, that even takes its name from Mega Man. Mega Man X has the air dash. This is that. It is literally just the Mega Man X air dash.
It's like an extrapolation of the wall running from like the Sands of Time and Warrior Within type games, except this time you can just do it anywhere.
Right. It's like you're running on the wall, but then there's no wall there and you're still running. And it's kind of like Looney Tunes. Like when you finally look down, that's when you drop.
Yeah. Coyote time activated at any time. I like that. I love the Rush. I think it's a very cool idea and a very cool way to execute that kind of power. It doesn't have the momentum that the X dash has, but it does have a similar, if slightly reversed, kind of utility, in that, as I mentioned, when you can double jump out of it means that you can hook around the underneath of like columns and things. You can, it adds a lot to the platforming, basically a lot of options. And it reminds me of something like Celeste, that kind of platformer. Not the difficulty necessarily, but the sort of mechanics of it just feel like something out of an indie game. And I appreciated that they made that work in this kind of environment.
Yes, the Celeste comparison, I think, is very difficult to ignore. And that is a conversation that happened a lot in our Discord with people playing in the Metroidvania Book Club section. It's extremely Celeste, especially when you get one of those Xerxes coins in one of the challenges and it floats around behind you. And you don't get to keep it until you get back to safety. Like, that is straight out of Celeste with the strawberries.
Having said that, that was straight out of Rayman Origins with the skull coins. So Ubisoft borrowed it back.
But we don't talk about Rayman Origins because it's but.
Wow, what an interesting opinion. I'll be sure to file that one in my shredder immediately.
Ubisoft PR didn't like me for a while because I reviewed it for 1UP. And they, yeah, there was some friction there.
I'm sorry to hear about your battles with Ubisoft PR.
That's okay. That's what PR is for.
Yeah, it is.
To create friction. anyway, so Rush is the first power. Kate, do you have anything to add about Rush?
No.
No? No Tom Sawyer jokes?
Oh, you
you're not going to use free will? Okay. the second ability that you get is Shadow of the Simurgh. And we've mentioned this a couple of times. The best way I can describe this power is that you can create a bookmark in space. So you're like running along, you trigger the power, and it just creates an after image of you that just stays there. And it doesn't do anything, and it just remains in place until you leave the room, until you dissolve it by holding down the button again for a while, or by tapping the button. When you tap the button, it causes you to warp back to the bookmark spot from wherever you happen to be. And apparently there's like an add-on power that you can get late in the game that turns this into a combat ability. But before that, this is really just a puzzle-solving tool. It's mm-hmm. It's very much about like, well, you know, the equivalent of Half-Life 2 saying, use the zero-point gravity gun to put a box down on this thing, and then you move over here and then manipulate it so you can get through a puzzle. But you know, keeping that Half-Life 2 comparison going. But instead of moving an object with zero-point gravity, you're just you. You're just using you. You're creating your afterimage and warping around, kind of backtracking instantly, almost instantly.
I thought this one was really interesting because it, aside from being quite fresh, it tries to activate gears in my brain that didn't previously exist, because there are some challenges later on where you need to use it. Not because initially it's introduced as like, oh, look, it's an advancing wall of death. How are you going to get past that? You drop it, you run away from the wall, and then you walk behind the wall. And I'm thinking, oh, this is kind of lame. It's just kind of another key and lock thing. But then, no. Later on, you have challenge rooms where, for example, you've got platforms that are recessed into the wall, and when you move past them, they come out, but only for a few seconds, and they go back in again. And those platforms are over spikes. The only way that you can activate them is by jumping above them, activating the shadow, falling through them so they activate, and then warping back to the shadow again so you land on a platform that's above you before it deactivates. Now, that doesn't sound too bad, but when you throw that into the mix with all the other stuff, that's a part of my brain that does not work. It's like, I don't remember that I can do this. I can't do this quickly or with any... I need to stop and think and look. And I can't because I'm above spikes. There are spikes to my side coming towards me. There are spikes everywhere. And you're asking me to remember two things at once. It's kind of crazy. And I'm not necessarily complaining. I think it's interesting. You know, they found a new mechanic for a platformer and they integrated it really successfully as if it had always been a thing. I never used it in combat, ever. Apart from there's a few attacks that you have to use it to dodge, which I always got killed by till I remembered it existed. But I do like it. I think it's cool how they brought this in and they didn't make it just a key and a lock. They made it something that you can use everywhere if you have the brain function to, which unfortunately I don't.
Yeah, now that you say it, I think that's the one that I always like forget that I have access to as well, because it's like the polar opposite of the one where you get to send a version of you forward by throwing a thing, you know. This is like, yeah. Oh, you're setting it in place behind, and that takes a completely different kind of thinking where you're like, yeah.
I like some of the limitations that they, or just some of the quirks that they invested into this ability. So one thing to note is that when you snap back to your shadow, it's not instantaneous. It's not like a warp. You know, like in Axiom Verge, when you kind of press through or use the ability to kind of translocate, it's pretty quick. A lot of games are like that. But in this one, there's kind of a process, and you're there's like an animation of your body sort of stretching back to the bookmark point. And that's not just an animation. That's happening in real time while the world continues to function. So this puts a limitation on it, which is that you can't use it to just like instantly dodge something. It's not like a get out of jail free card. You have to kind of be careful with your timing. And, you know, one of the first instances, the first uses you have for this is those really annoying, like, slug-ass guys with the sewer grates that they use as a shield and block up corridors. And they'll charge at you and keep you from going through those narrow corridors. But you can use this when they're kind of at the far back of their territory and drop your little bookmark guy and then let it, you know, lure it forward as you know, as a way to kind of get the enemy away from its default position, and then snap back behind it and immediately start smashing it with a sword or, you know, arrows or whatever on its butt, and that kills it. And it's very satisfying the first time you do that. But where was I going with this? I got carried away thinking about those slug butts. So, you know, it's useful for that, but you can't use it to just like evade enemies. You have to really be mindful of your placement, where you put it, the timing on it. Like if you let those narrow corridor slug butt guys back up too much, then when you return to your shadow bookmark, you're going to basically materialize inside of it. And we've all seen Star Trek and knows what happens when you materialize inside another object. That's the end of the story for you. So you have to avoid doing that. And I think that's a pretty cool limitation. Also, there's no physics on the bookmark guy. So you can't use it to like, you know, hold open a grate or something, you know, pull a lever and then warp away from it. Yeah. You have to kind of be mindful of the fact that, you know, only your actual body has mass and weight. And so things that are triggered by your physical presence, you can't just use the shadow bookmark as a way to kind of double up on that. There are some exceptions, you know, but it's really pretty specific. And as a general rule, you can't use it as just like a free crate to put on a switch or something like that.
Yeah, it's another one that synergizes with sort of later puzzle rooms and other abilities that you get, where, again, with the double jump, you can double jump, activate it, drop, go back to it, and then do your second jump from that, basically. So you can get up quite high using it, but it's rarely needed it's never really under pressure. It's just for puzzle rooms, really, which is why I didn't really use it that much in combat. I just didn't think to, because I didn't feel like I needed to. I had enough other options that it, even the guys who have shields up, I felt it was quicker just to jump over them and hit them, or break their shields with the power up, or with the hook shot that you get later, which I've just spoiled. Sorry, everyone.
Are you talking about the Fabric of Time?
Is that what it was called? I just called it the hookshot. Okay. That's what it is.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the third power you get, I think, or, you know, it's not linear. You could get a different power first. Clairvoyance kind of seems like the big power for the game, the one that opens up the most paths. I mean, I guess the Rush also does that in Double Jump, but this one, I feel, makes use of more like built-in contrivances, whereas the Rush is an extension of, you know, just your moveset. It's very much about your maneuvering. Clairvoyance is, it allows you to, according to the game, see into another reality, which basically means that it reveals pathways or causes things to disappear depending on which dimension you're looking into. But from what I understand, and admittedly I did not make it far enough to get this, sorry, it seems like clairvoyance basically reveals things that the designers have put there. You're not like creating paths. It's like, Oh, this room was full of blocks and you couldn't see them before, but now you can. And so you can get through this room because you have blocks to maneuver on.
By and large, you're just turning platforms and walls on and off, and obstacles occasionally. It's mostly used for, I would say, apart from the critical path stuff, it's mostly for puzzle rooms or action rooms where, for example, you're on a moving platform and you have to turn the spikes off and then turn them back on again because the spikes that were previously there are now elsewhere. It is quite cool when you throw it into the mix with not, you know, you're air dashing, you're double jumping, you're also turning terrain on and off, and one half of the terrain you're turning on and off has spikes on it so you can't cling to it, and all sorts of stuff like that. But it's probably the least interesting power that you get because it is so situational.
Yeah, it seems very much it's basically like, hey, let's reveal what the developers have baked into this space. And I know you need to use it to defeat the jailer, which apparently like takes him out of a pocket dimension and removes his ability to heal himself. Are there other situations in the game where clairvoyance interferes with the way, you know, a character functions? Because so many of the bosses seem to kind of warp around, make use of dimension shifting and time effects and things like that. So I don't know if clairvoyance becomes a combat ability, but it really seems to be very much just a, like, hey, here's an alternate path situation.
I can't remember.
I don't recall it being used in any other combat, but then again, as I said, I did turn your difficulty down, so it's possible I just battered everything before they got to use their clairvoyance things. But it is fun. It's not, again, it's something I've seen before, but I feel like I've never seen it done as intricately as they do it here. It's like the sense of confidence over the design of each room is really quite impressive, and all the more maddening when they're absolutely stomping your face into the ground over and over again because you keep dropping your stupid Xerxes coins.
Yeah, it kind of seems like they basically created a second world with different platforms and overlaid them, and so you're kind of shifting between those worlds. So it's like having both castles of Castlevania, the regular and inverted castle, where you can just immediately shift between them, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. It is that, but also it as a world's go, it really is just in a series of rooms. There'll be a challenge room that uses this, and not really anywhere else. I was hoping that maybe there'd be some examples of places where you go into an area that's kind of empty, and then you turn it on and there are some invisible crystal clusters or something, but that didn't seem to be a thing. That's something I would have put in the game. Hire me, Ubisoft. Oh, wait, actually, God, don't. I've just seen what's happening over there.
No, I don't think you'd want more crystals. The crazy challenges that you go through just to get more crystals would seem even more pointless. So I feel like that's working to counter purposes, cross purposes.
Okay, definitely don't hire me, Ubisoft. I'm obviously bad at this.
So the Gravity Wings power is the double jump. Is there something about Gravity Wings that is different than a double jump, like a standard double jump?
I don't think so. It's just kind of like throughout the game, you know, they would taunt you with these things that are like, if only I could jump a little higher. Oh, I must get some double jump later, but when? And then you eventually get it and you're like, there are so many places I know I can use this, you know? Go, like, backtracking and trying to clean up the map.
It's useful, obviously, for hang time during combat. Like, if you're firing arrows, for example, from the air, you can fire, double jump, fire again without landing. Because I think the arrows are the secret weapon of this game if you level them up enough. You can really save a lot of time with the arrows. But the double jump, the main cool thing about it for me is the realization that you can, which is very similar to something like the old indie game Jumper, which was made by Maddie, who made Celeste, actually, I believe. When you realize you can single jump off a wall, dash in the air, or rush, as it's called here, Simog Rush, and then do another jump, that's very liberating. It means that you can essentially climb up anything within reason. And that feels very good and cool, I think.
Oh, yeah, one thing that I do like about this game is the power, I guess, or consumable, this resource that it gives you called memory shards, basically anywhere on the map you can say, oh, that looks like something I'm going to need to come back to later. And you don't just put a map point on there, but you take a screenshot that is embedded in the map. And that's such a great idea because, you know, you make 20 of these marks on a map over the course of 20 hours of play. And then you look at the map and you're like, well, what the hell was that? But when you have the screenshot there It just means you can immediately say, oh, yeah, that seems like a spot I need to double jump. Or, you know, there's like some sort of grapple point here that clearly is trying to take me someplace else, but I don't have a grapple yet. So really, really great idea. And one that I think, you know, as frustrated as I got by just how expansive this game is and how much backtracking there is through the same territory to kind of figure out where to go, I feel like that is a huge time saver and like a real kind of nod to the fact that we are human beings who have lives and have to do stuff. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, we talked about it last episode. That is a fantastic feature, and I kind of wish that every game with a map had that. I don't just mean 2D, I don't just mean Metroidvania. Like, I want to be able to do that on any game with a big map, put a screenshot down that I can then maybe annotate. Although what's nice here is, as well as the memory shards, which you can get more of, they're an item you can upgrade, mm-hmm. which is, I thought, was quite interesting. You can also place your little markers with different icons on them. You know, that is also a thing. They're very friendly with labeling this map as much as you like, and I appreciated that a lot. I only wish that it helped more.
It does you no good when you stop playing in an area where you have no map because someone's stolen it.
Well, I didn't... I mean, I take screenshots quite early on because there are these little bits that are very obviously a thing. There's like a tile on the ground you can't interact with. And I couldn't figure out what to do with it. Even right at the end of the game, I was like, hang on a minute, I still haven't found out what's going on with those pressure plate-looking things. And then I found out by sort of accident that those are just for like puzzles that I didn't know were in the game. There's one, for example, where there's one in the middle of an area with four statues, two on each side, both firing arrows into the sky, like pointing their bows into the sky. And I thought, what if I stood in the middle and just fire an arrow up where they intersect, and boom, chest appears. And I'm like, oh, there are actual kind of environmental puzzles in this game that I'd somehow completely overlooked. That's quite cool. So I appreciated that.
Yeah, like I said, they put everything into this game. They were just like, here's a space, let's put a thing in here, even if it's just crystals. So most of the abilities that the Simurgh gives you, or that you acquire from the Simurgh, or however you want to parse it, are really about traversal, maneuvering, navigation, movement, etc. Yeah. But I feel like the Dimensional Claw kind of bucks that trend, because it's not really, it doesn't help you maneuver, but it is something that you can use both in puzzles and in combat. And it's kind of a cool concept. I'm trying to think if there is another game that has something similar, you know, where basically you create like a little yawning portal into another dimension that can capture a thing, and then you can spit that out. Is it called Kirby?
No, well, you're not going to like this. It's quite similar. In Smash Brothers, the Animal Crossing villager can catch projectiles in his pocket and then throw them out later, and that's what it reminded me of. At least that to me it is, because I only realized again today that you can use this, because you need to use this to grab these bomb things to take to breakable walls and throw them into the walls. And then I sort of thought, hang on a minute, can you do this with like arrows, enemy bullets? And it turns out yes, you can. And I thought that was extraordinarily cool, and I wish I'd figured it out quite a lot earlier in the game.
This is another ability that I unfortunately regularly would forget that I had, but yet it's so like clever that like I wish I was thinking about more like opportunities to use it. Maybe it's because like in the heat of a battle, I just like my brain shuts off and I'm just like mashing buttons. I'm not really thinking strategically in fights.
Well, I think also, you know, video games have kind of their standard vocabulary. They have, you know, the air dash, they have the double jump, they have things like that. And this is something I've noticed in some of the Zelda games, where sometimes you get a power that just bucks the like conventions of video gaming, and it's like something you've never seen before. It's this very unique ability. And, you know, in Zelda, those tend to be extremely situational. Once you clear that dungeon, it's like, do I ever need this again? No.
Yeah, but the spinner.
But, you know, and then occasionally, you know, you do need it and you forget that you have it because it's so bizarre or outlandish or just like difficult to understand, like, how am I going to use this? Like, even like Mega Man 8, you know, Mega Man's basic power is, his special power is kicking effectively a soccer ball of energy, and you almost never use that in that game, but then you get to the final boss and you need to defeat the final boss by using that. So it's kind of like sort of like punishing you for not making use of this beautiful, amazing, unique ability that they have given you, you Philistine. You know, you break away from the way video games normally work. And I do think people, unless they are, you know, regularly reminded, like, hey, this exists, use it. It's easy to forget that, you know, they've thrown this thing that you've never seen in there before. But at the same time, I don't know that there's a way to elegantly do that that doesn't feel like a contrivance, unless you build the game or like parts of the game around that ability. So, yeah, I feel like this is maybe one of those abilities that, you know, again, speaking kind of out of my ass, not having gotten this far in the game myself, but I feel like it's one of those things that might have fared better if there weren't so much to this game already. If they had included this as like a central mechanic in a simpler, more streamlined game, I could see it becoming, you know, like give us a drill dozer kind of experience that's just built around the dimensional claw. And you've got yourself a fun little, you know, 4 to 5 hour game that'll go down easy and people will remember fondly 20 years later, even if they're like, yeah, that's a good, you know, solid C+, B- game. But here it just, I feel like it this kind of thing has the tendency to get lost in the background noise.
I spent this entire segment after you mentioned like making a Rush joke. I was like, it's a Rush joke I could make. And the best Rush joke is also from the era that I prefer to forget, where it's like, well, you could make a joke about time stand still, couldn't you? But
oh, there you go.
But I try to not remember that song. Fair. I was like, is there a lyric in 2112 that works for that?
Can I try one? No.
You've resumed
Prince
control.
Of Perth, sure.
Ah, there you go.
Best I can do.
Okay.
Shite.
All right.
Turn my back to the wind to catch my breath before I start off again. Living on me by the moment to spend.
I hope you're not getting embarrassed.
Oh, nice.
Okay. Someone want to make an Alex Lifeson joke? No. Okay. So the final Simurgh ability that I'm aware of, maybe there were more that, again, I didn't discover myself because I didn't play this game very well, is the Fabric of Time, which is basically a grappling hook.
Yeah.
It's like a hook shot.
Yeah. More or less, yeah. There are specific points in the map that you can hook to, but also you can use it to pull things and take enemies' armor or shields off them, which is extremely useful.
I am a big fan of that sort of thing.
It's one of the things in the game, along with the not so much the double jump, but I felt like it would have been cooler to have this sooner than you get it, which is right at the end. I feel like this could have been replaced with the Chakram teleport. I think that's much more situational, but I ain't complaining, because by the time I had this thing, I was all in with the game because the story had kicked in and I'd started actually kind of enjoying the characters and the emotions behind it. But we'll get to that, I expect.
All right, so those are, you know, we talked about some of the basic powers last episode, and, you know, really the Simurgh powers are what sort of adds on to that and gives it more uniqueness. So by the end, you have so many abilities. You have all the Simurgh powers, plus you have a pair of swords, which you can, you know, use to attack on the ground. You can juggle enemies. You can do air attacks. You can do Yoshi butt stomps with your swords. You've got arrows, which you can use, but then if you hold down the arrow button, then you have a chakram that flies out and flies back, and, you know, it follows a weird path to get back to you and will always come back, you know, regardless of where you've moved. So you can use it to great effect that way. Geez, I feel like, you know, that's in addition to things like dashing on the ground, sliding, climbing walls, or, you know, gripping onto walls, ledge grips. There's just a lot you can do. It's kind of daunting, but it does, yeah. It does really feel like, you know, if a character has ever had a physical ability in a video game, the prince has those abilities. Well, or sorry, not the prince. Yeah, I mean, I gosh, Sargon.
Sargon.
The prince is dead.
Yeah.
The princess Mort.
Yeah. Are we allowed to spoil the game? I guess we have.
Go for it. Yeah, everyone at this point
he's only initially dead. He comes back. You get him back. Yeah. It's okay.
I spoiled that part for myself. I was like, oh, that's a really cool twist. It makes perfect sense with the time travel stuff, but, yeah. You know, you always think about that in the game in terms of, like, you know, the gameplay. But to actually jump back in time and say, no, I'm going to keep this thing from happening that set everything in motion, that's creating paradoxes right there. And yet they did it.
So, something I want to note, because you mentioned, because when you said the prince, is something that occurred to me today, which is the stuff that you can do, like thinking back about Prince of Persia, like 89, Apple II, whatever, you know, the Prince of Persia, he is athletic, but he's not someone I ever saw as, he's a guy, he's a human being, and he's clambering all over these things in a way that you or I could if we, you know, if we kept up with the CrossFit.
He was the original parkour hero.
Yeah, and of course, in the PS2 games, things get a little bit more spectacular, but you aren't double jumping, you are climbing things, you are doing... I mean, the wall run is ridiculous, yes, but we've seen parkour guys do something a bit like that, so it is within the realms of, like, you believe this guy could do this. And in this game, you are so air dash, double jump, all this crazy stuff, and it got me thinking a little bit, like... It's kind of weird that this is Prince of Persia, like, because you are so much more mobile than you are in any of those games, and I don't associate this kind of agility, or, I mean, this specific kind of agility, with the Prince of Persia series, and I'm not complaining, I just thought it was interesting that it was a departure in that respect.
Well, again, this isn't the prince. He's not, he hasn't grown up, you know, with his Habsburg chin, being fed peeled grapes in a palace. He is an immortal... As previously seen in Immortals: Phoenix Rising by Ubisoft, so that is why he's very powerful.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so to end this, I would like to go back to our community. But before we do that, I feel like, you know, I just want to hear the two of you who have genuinely played through this game to share your thoughts on, you know, any other thoughts you have about memorable parts of the game. Like, it's a spoiler, spoilers allowed kind of zone, so whatever works for you. But just, like, what stands out, you know, in terms of set pieces, combat, areas, etc., beyond just the mechanics that we've talked about, like the environments, because the environments are literally a huge part of this game.
I'm not a big fan of bosses, so those don't stick with me in general. For me, it's the abilities that stick with me, and to a lesser extent, like the different areas. Like if I see a photo or a clip of an area, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember what that area was like. But I hate to say it, but in some ways, the areas in some ways feel like a little bit bland, to where the most memorable areas are the ones where, like, I encountered something frustrating. I'm like, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I remember that area. That, like, spiky, like, gem walls or whatever that will kill ya, or, you know, like, the area with all the weird scientists, the bearded scientist guys.
The
alchemists throwing potions at you. That was fun. I liked that. It was different and weird. I really enjoyed that part. You know, for my part, I forgot that I had actually, to get there, I had to go through the Hyrcanian Forest. When I was putting together notes for this, I was like, the Hyrcanian Forest? I wonder if that comes at, like, the end of the game? What is that? And then I reviewed a video and I was like, oh, I actually played through that part. I totally forgot about that. It just, there was nothing about it that stuck with me. Yeah, I mean, going back to, since I've already mentioned it a couple of times in this episode, Axiom Verge, one thing that I think that that game does really well is to make each area very distinct, not just in terms of visuals, but also in terms of like its atmosphere, the music. Like there's different mechanics and weird stuff happening in each zone of Axiom Verge. So, you know, it makes it very easy to kind of mentally map out the game. You kind of remember like, oh, you know, this bizarre stuff was happening in that one area, so that's where I need to head back to, or that's where this thing is hidden or whatever. And I feel like this game does, for the most part, you know, there's so much volume to the spaces. And if you just like scrub through YouTube videos, the areas kind of look pretty similar, you know, with some exceptions, obviously. And, you know, I love how bright and open and sunlit like the old Royal Road is. You know, the Upper City has its own look. The catacombs are horrible, but they are distinctive because it's like the entire place is made out of rotting corpses that are just waiting to burst, and then sometimes bugs come out of them. Mm-hmm. So that's memorable, but it does kind of have that, yeah, that sort of repetitive feel to it where, yeah, I don't know. I don't want to be too hard on it. I think it's tough to make a 2.5D game that kind of has a realistic look vibe to it, and still, you know, parts of it stand out. Like if you go cartoony and kind of vibrant and flamboyant, which they could have done given, you know, the kind of the environment in this game, I think you can make things stand out. But yeah, it's like it feels like this was kind of designed by people who are thinking in terms of 3D modeling, where traversing those spaces is more memorable because it's immersive. But here, not so much. I don't know.
I want to change fair. My answer quick because okay. It just took me an extra moment to think of an extra thing memorable that I liked. But I think I did it during the previous half of the game. There is the there's those series of like puzzle rooms that involve like time travel where there ends up being multiple use.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, you have to,
like that time travel thing is, I think, like I found those super challenging and sometimes a little like sometimes it felt like a slog, but it also the whole time felt really clever in that same kind of way as like the third Time Splitters game where you would encounter your old self, you know, during the story, if you played that. But like
I played Gradius 5, which does
that. Oh, okay. All right.
Sorry. A couple of things I want to mention real quick, if I may, Jeremy.
Please do mention.
First of all, it's interesting that you mentioned Immortals Fenyx Rising, because not many people do, but I feel like that game was to, you know, Breath of the Wild what this game was to Hollow Knight, The Lost Chronicles to Hollow Knight, because it's Ubisoft seeing something popular and saying, hey, we could do that, but we could make that a little bit more accessible. We could file the edges down. Is it accessible in the sense of lose the weapon breaking, put the waypoints on the map, you know, get make it more AAA-ish. And I'm not saying that as a dirty word, because, I mean, Hollow Knight, interestingly enough, I think Hollow Knight has a very samey map. But something they do that's very simple that helps you to remember the distinction between the zones is A, the music, and B, the color scheme completely changes. And the music in this game, which is very well done music, I think it's all orchestral and everything, it all kind of sounds like the same music the whole way through. There's a lot of the same kind of sounds that you're hearing, and I think that means that transitioning between areas doesn't really feel quite so, oh cool, new thing. It's more of, it's just a slightly different version of what I was already in. That's not to say it's badly done or they aren't distinct. I mean, I've already mentioned the pirate ship, which I thought was a superb area. It would have been a superb area in any game. I thought that was genius. I wish they'd done more like that, areas that were completely frozen in time and had some interesting kind of gimmick that came off that, but I just thought it was kind of much easier than Hollow Knight, you know, in many respects, but in a sense that also robs it of a sense of identity. But you know, there are people who can't stand Hollow Knight who love this game, and I get it. Like, I completely get it. You know, I didn't used to like Breath of the Wild, but I liked Immortals Fenyx Rising because it was saying, "Hey, go there and do this." Then later, I started liking Breath of the Wild. I was like, "Oh, I see. I get this now. I see what they want from me now." And that's something that I guess could happen to others. But the only other thing I wanted to mention, because we didn't talk about it that much, and this is probably just a personal thing, is I think that this game does something that Ubisoft does generally quite well, which is it has a really interesting villain, in my opinion, because the villain is, his motivation is kind of logical. It kind of makes sense. You can see where he's coming from. He doesn't seem like he's a terrible guy. He just seems like he's been forced into like this decision he's made. And as you learn why he's like that, you see his past, you see what happened to him, you find out that he is like the rightful heir of Persia. And you're like, oh, okay, this is much more interesting than, like, just kind of Skeletor, you know? And I did appreciate the emotion in the fact that the prince would be forced into fighting his former friends, who he would then have these kind of parting words of sorrow with. I liked that after you defeat Menelaus, when you're running around, occasionally the prince will just kind of go like, ah, Menelaus, like, you know, he's not over
it. You mean Sargon?
God damn it, see?
It's okay, we all do it. We all do it.
This is why they did. They should have called the game Sargon. There's no negative things based on that name whatsoever.
No, it makes me think of the bubble bath. Sargon, take me away.
It makes me think of Calgon, which washing machines live longer with. But, of course, that's not the case here.
It makes me think of that chess game. Was that called Sargon, or was it? There was a chess game
I think
around
so,
the
yes.
Prince of Persia.
But overall, I don't think it's perfect. I mean, the plot has its sort of simplistic stuff. It's delivered in a fairly staid manner, I think. But I do think that Ubisoft tend to put a little bit more effort into their villains than most companies seem to. So it worked for me. It did hit for me. I liked the tragedy of the whole thing and the whole kind of, no, we can fix this, we can redeem this, we don't have to kill this guy. I'm a bit of a sucker for villainous kind of redemption, or villains who realize that they were wrong, and even if it's too late, you know. So that trope hits for me, and I liked the general sense of hope in the end when you have the young Varkum talking about, oh, I've seen what I become, I don't want to be like that, you must have stopped me from being like that. And then in the end, he's with, I think her name is Naith, as the prince rides off into the sunset for his next adventure. And the whole thing, to me, came together story-wise in the last third. I started really appreciating what they were doing. Even, it's not the most original story in the world, but I thought the execution was fun. I enjoyed it. And I did get a little tiny bit of emotion from it. So, you know, I don't normally feel emotions, obviously, but this time, just a little bit from my little princey.
Aw, you're going to turn into a real boy one of these days.
I know, but not today.
I liked some of the story beats. I just felt like it could have been written better. Like, the beats could have been handled better. And, you know, I liked the twist, the weird twist about encountering this boy, this young boy who you later discover is the guy that you're fighting. But I totally missed, I guess, the part of establishing his motivation. He just seemed like, well, I was kind of like skipping as much as I could and not paying that much attention to the story. So I caught the bit about the boy, but I was like, I didn't catch any of his motivation being like, oh, you could kind of understand this.
Well,
it's like
he's like the heir to Persia. He should be the one to receive the blessing of the Simurgh, the powers of the Simurgh. He doesn't get them. And then, of course, it turns out later that the actual queen murdered his father, King Darius, so he could never get, you know, his birthright. So I think you can, I do think it's, I don't think it's perfect, you know. It's just, I liked it more than just, like, I want this power so I can rule the world. Like, no, I want this power because it is rightfully mine, and I have been quite egregiously wronged. And, of course, the player character, you know, you don't know that either. And when you find that out, it's like, oh, okay, yeah. I mean, you're still evil, kind of. But, yeah, I kind of see where you're coming from. That is kind of fucked up. Like, you know? But I don't know. I think it's just that I am a real sucker for that kind of trope, really. It works for me. And Ubi are good at doing that, I find. Like, I mean, Assassin's Creed, whenever you kill anyone in Assassin's Creed, you always get the little speech about, oh, actually, I was in the right because of this, 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 and this. I just appreciate that they make the effort, really, instead of just... Well, I suppose I was about to say instead of just having Hitler's head explode, but obviously there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, everyone should... We all want that, you know.
No, that's pretty good. So, thank you for your thoughts. Let's wrap this up by going back to the community, because the community on Discord did have a lot to say. Thank you all for taking part of this, even though this this episode fell behind quite badly, and that is mostly my fault. So, my bad. If you could both be so kind as to pull up your notes that I put together and look down for community stuff, we're going to take turns reading things, so it's not just me talking for half an hour. So I'll start with Galaga Wiki, who says, I'm so happy this game is being covered. It's so good. I think my favorite surprise was the combat training you get in your home base. I thought it'd be like, here's how to do a three-hit combo, but when it started teaching me how to, like, extend my air combos with the bow, I knew this was real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a real solid... combat system in there that I failed to engage with on any meaningful level.
Same. I played all the tutorials because you unlock, you know, stuff from it, but then I would promptly forget beyond, like, could I use this to, like, in a button mashing situation?
You get Uplay points for...
Oh, yeah. I unlocked the Young Prince tutorials. Skin on Uplay.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I was in it mostly for the shards or whatever to unlock stuff from, you know, yeah.
That one lady.
Yeah.
All the memorable characters in this game.
Yeah. So, okay, do you want to read this next one so it's not Stuart fluffing himself up?
How do you pronounce that name?
Makuelos?
Makuelos? Stuart mentioned this in the podcast, and I agree. It's stupid that failing the parry is treated like a critical miss and inflicts extra damage over whatever you otherwise would have gotten without parrying. This also happens if you happen to be facing the wrong direction, which was a problem for me on some of the DLC boss attacks.
Worth noting that there is an accessibility option that means that parries will work from any direction regardless of where you're facing, and I think that that probably should have been there from the off, honestly. But also, I think that the critical miss parry thing is the one thing in this game that just should not be in it. Like, it's so infuriating. It's like, okay, give me chip damage, but don't make me get hurt more than I would have from just taking the hit. You know, it's dumb. I really hate that. Guillermo J. I will defend the story in The Lost Crown, partly since I don't play many modern AAA games and I'm not as jaded by their rhythms, but it did keep me engaged and curious. And even though the third act suffers from a bland resolution and a weak antagonist, boo to that, it still paid off my curiosity in cool ways, which I won't mention until the next podcast. Unfortunately, we have now mentioned them. Which brings me to one of the game's strongest points, and maybe its most distinctive, its setting. I think Mount Caff?
Sure. Quaff
is a brilliant play space with incredible aesthetics that allow the designers free rein in terms of spectacle and creature design, and it also amplified the story, making it much grander than it is on paper. Also, the prince getting killed genuinely surprised me, never mind how the game's title foreshadows it. I also love the real I also love the pieces of real life lore that we get in the game. Made me want to learn more about Middle Eastern folklore, which alone was worth the price of admission. Combat wise, I never got fully perfect with parrying, but honestly, dodging and dashing are far more important mechanics. As long as you move around and stay nimble, you'll be fine against most enemies.
So there's a vote for the story and a vote against the boss. So it's like the opposite of Stuart. Woe says, I think the problem for me with the story is that most of the characters don't really have character. There is a big dialogue dump at the start, talking to them. But by the time things are happening, 15 hours have passed, and you most likely have forgotten most of what went on with them. But I play a lot of indie games that when they try telling stories, they try to be more weird and interesting with the characters. Whether or not they work, they tend to try to make them memorable. And I just feel like Lost Crown never really gets there.
Yeah, this is a big deal with like the second half of the game, where the second half is so much about like suddenly we know why there's this giant cast of characters, because they want to kill them off like Alien style or whatever, right? But like, because they didn't put enough into giving them unique personalities, you don't really like that. That could have been really brutal, like, oh, I have to kill these people who are trying to kill me that were my friends. But now it's just like, oh, this is just another generic boss, you know?
Yeah, I felt a little bit the same way, even though I did appreciate sort of the beats that they hit. When, I've said his name already, but I've forgotten it. The spear guy that you fight, sort of the bow guy that you fight, all of a sudden is kind of like, oh, we had this plan, we had that plan. And I was like, well, really? When did that come up? Like, I don't remember any of this. But I still thought it kind of landed for me. But then again, I guess I'm maybe just not that fussy about the story. Not that I'm saying you are. That came off as quite negative towards... Oh. That's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. I just meant, I guess, that I was just kind of like, meh, it's okay, you know?
I'm critical, it's in the name.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, that's why I'm called Relaxed Stuart.
That's on your trading card.
Apathy Jip.
Jispixis says, well, I agree with Stuart and Chris that there is probably an even better game if the team had tuned it more. I think the degree to which you can customize the difficulty was underrated. I think what they needed was a preset setting that kept environmental damage at normal and reduced time spent fighting, called something less judgmental. Well, number two, while I too object to being locked in rooms with enemies in general, the whole ethos of Prince of Persia was that combat was intended to block you and make you win highly technical fights. In this regard, it is very much a true Prince of Persia.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Number three, I think Stuart underrated the value of the amulets in general. While some are duds, there are many effective loadouts for many desired playstyles, and I have switched around a lot so far. Number four, Jeremy is absolutely right that the major problem with combat is the extremely antiquated and unimaginative approach to respawns. The underlying reasons for this is that the game's upgrade economy is extremely greedy, and you have to grind a lot to get good upgrades, which means fighting a lot. That is my biggest complaint about the game, for sure. Number five, as Jeremy said in the end, it is a very fun game. If you are a lover of Salt and Sanctuary and Blasphemous, maybe you won't touch the difficulty or even crank it up. But for the rest of us, there are lots of ways to radically reduce the combat irritation. I have my damage inflicted up and energy HP low, and my parry time window extended. That keeps the flavor of the parrying quite present while making fighting much of a slog.
I gotta say, I played Blasphemous as way easier than this game. Like, I'm sorry, not even like doing a bit. That game's not that hard compared to this, I found. Also, Jeremy said it's a very fun game. Interesting.
Remember when you said that? There. It was a very fun
game. That was a different me.
Yeah, also, point one, I absolutely do agree with about the difficulty tuning, and I have copped to that here on this podcast, cap in hand. I've come to you begging forgiveness. But I'm sorry, but no, the amulets, they sucked. Like, in a, I would keep unlocking new amulet slots and being like, I don't care. So I'm not going to use none of these. I'm not going to use any of these. Like, oh yeah, reduce fire damage. Like, how many things do fire damage in this game? Like, one. Doesn't matter. Rubbish. Amulets in the bin. Oh, sorry. Am I reading Stuart? This? J. Beeblebrooks. Some of the names of these people, Jeremy. Call me an easy sucker for any
superpower. You should call him
J-Fod. Oh yeah, could do. Call me an easy sucker for any superpowered group. Dead Cell. I don't know what that means. But
Metal Gear Solid 2.
Oh, yeah, I haven't played that. Sorry, everyone. I immediately like the Immortals because I'm looking forward to fighting them. It is largely fueled by the fact that humanoid enemies with player abilities are usually just more fun to fight in video games than big, slow monsters or vehicles. This rule applies to any game from Souls-likes to Castlevania. Albus is more fun in Order of Ecclesia than any giant crab or skeleton or centaur or whatever, to freaking Kirby, where I used to replay the final level of Meta Knight scenario just to sword fight the guy.
I like killing that tree. I don't know what he did to piss off Kirby, but Wispy Woods had it coming.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, you know, honestly. And
do you have a thought?
I wrote an article about it. You could Google, why does Kirby hate that tree so damn much, and you'll find it.
Okay, but does it have let's say that do? I'm on a podcast and Google it. It's not a great answer.
Okay, DuckDuckGo then? No, I'm kidding. honestly, I think that Kirby just hates that tree for no real reason. I think it's just one. Sometimes you see a person in the street and you just think, I hate that guy, you know? Someone you've never met before in your entire life. It's not based on anything. You just immediately hate them and you want to kill them, but you don't because of the law, and you move on with your life. And I think that's how Kirby feels, except instead of not killing them, he just kills them.
Is that also why Kirby likes to kill the enemies that are just sleeping on the ground, minding their own business?
Yeah, I think for Kirby, killing is just like breathing, as which he does also, obviously, because that's how he kills them. He breathes them in.
Yeah, that is true.
Jason J says, I almost bounced off the Lost Crown game twice. First was when I had to sign up for an Ubisoft account when playing on PS5, then at the first boss fight. Hey, I stuck with it because of the book club and completed the game on the default warrior difficulty. To me, it feels like a mix of the tough combat of Metroid Dread and the fairly intense platforming of Ori and the Blind Forest. I usually hate parrying, but once I figured it out, I mostly enjoyed it, except when there were multiple enemies attacking simultaneously.
Which is all the time.
Yeah. The game is very challenging, but most of the truly brutal stuff is optional, though I almost rage quit during a few boss fights. I didn't use the difficulty options, but liked knowing they were there. I loved the huge interconnected world, though it was almost too big, and the main quest is a bit too long. The story is meh, with some plot holes, and most of the characters are forgettable, though I liked Sargon himself in finding Fariba. Fariba, that's her name, in hidden places. It's easy to nitpick this game, but I sunk 35 hours into it, and don't regret it. I'm glad that Ubisoft tried something besides what Bob Mackey calls game loaf. I was disappointed there won't be a sequel, despite it selling well.
Porifera says, feel like this game is really hurt by the idea that it has to have everything a AAA game has. That's why the combat system sticks out to me. It's so elaborate because that's the conventional way to design a game, but all the real creativity is in the platforming. Also, fun fact, clairvoyance is essentially just Danny Phantom's power in the GBA version of Nicktoons' Battle for Volcano Island.
Represent.
That is a pull.
Hell yeah.
I would not at all be surprised if that game stole the mechanic from something else, but it's the only other instance of the mechanic I'm aware of. Clairvoyance occasionally also spawning in enemies is a really clever touch, though.
I always find that Nicktoons Battle for Volcano Island is like the example of so many games that you can encounter, don't you think? All roads tend to lead to Nicktoons Battle for Volcano Island.
I am unfamiliar with it, or what else it inspired.
Well, just wait for my upcoming 3-hour episode about it, and it'll be...
Excellent. You know, I will look forward to that.
Just one episode?
Oh, no. We'll probably split it into at least 2 or 3.
Right, okay.
Jay Beeblebrooks, again, says, I see parries in Lost Crown as a get-out-of-jail card, and enemies absolutely take the bait if you advance on them, particularly spearmen who have such immediacy to their attacks, which is appropriate for a thrusting weapon, but the risk comes with whiffing it. Again, Sargon is more maneuverable than every enemy. The safest choice is always distance, which works against every creature that's not a boss. To be safer, stun them with a bow or chakram or charged blade wave before closing the distance. But more to my observation, their enemies are more aggressive in a group. There are some enemies deemed trickier, like the pirates and ratmen, who don't take the bait except when they outnumber you, which I find to be an interesting state to exist in. like study some of the mooks in Streets of Rage or Final Fight. They'll do this little dance to come in range and have a timer where they think about their next action. Get two guys flanking you and the next action is almost always to smack you. Cannot stand... Oh, is almost always a smack. You cannot sit still. Now, I would agree with this if not for the fact that there are almost always enemies with bows firing them at you the whole time when you are trying to do this distance thing. I get it. I see where you're coming from. And it probably is the most effective way to fight, but it's still really quite difficult to do it that way. But I guess that JB Wilbrox is just better than me at Prince of Persia. I'm going to have to face up to that, you know? Well, as long
I'll
as
come to terms with that at some point.
Well, at least there's no more comments from JB Wilbrox. And oh my goodness.
Yeah, Kate, you want to grab that one?
JB Wilbrox again says, "My final thoughts. The Lost Crown is arguably bloated and messy, but I can make this argument about the entire genre, which has mostly left behind the minimalism of the early Metroid games to fully embrace the Igavania kitchen sink approach. The Lost Crown is at its best when it's tightly focused platforming challenges, but it's still immensely pleasing to zip through old areas with new powers, and that's the juice that keeps me drinking from the Metroidvania well. As an aside, it's interesting to watch Metroidvanias become a sandbox for a Switch Army Knife approach to design. Like, on the surface, D-Lit in Wonder Labyrinth is a Symphony plus Cave Story clone, but with an added Ikaruga-inspired color swapping that may or may not be necessary, but a bullet hell approach to boss design is unusual in a platformer." We sure have a lot of people in the chat named J. Beeblebrox.
Yeah, it's a weird coincidence.
they're all different versions of J. Beeblebrox throughout time.
Yeah, fully
coming cool. together all at once to join in the podcast. I wanted to read one comment from Porifera on Discord that came in kind of late. They said, I wanted to be more positive on the game because I was kind of bummed at how lukewarm everyone's being. But I'm only on the more positive side of lukewarm myself. I like the puzzle platform bits a lot, but the 2.5D really hurts some of the more difficult challenges. The power set is very good, and the add-on that you get that turns the Shadow of the Simurgh into a combat ability really makes the combat a lot better. But then also, I think the whole thing is very over-designed relative to how interesting the actual content is. Compared to something like the Igavanias, this game doesn't wear over-designed especially well. But I do love the sincere interest in Persian culture the game seems to have. And I agree on a lot of that. Mm-hmm. I do want to wrap up the community comments with a note from Scott, who says, "It's best when Celeste, it's slight when you fight."
That's pretty good, yeah.
So one vote there in favor of the puzzle platforming over the combat. I want to go back to wrap this up to what Jay Beeblebrox's final comment said, talking about the evolution of the Metroidvania and what the Lost Crown represents. This is the thing that I actually spent a lot of time kind of struggling with myself today, as I realized not only am I not going to finish this game, also I'm terrible at it and should never be allowed to touch a game like this again. You know, the fact that I don't necessarily like the Lost Crown is not a knock on the game, and I think it actually speaks highly for how the concept of Metroidvania has evolved. Because, having put together a book on like the prehistory of Metroidvania games throughout the 1980s and how all the different primal roots sort of came together into those early like NES games, the occasional like Master System or PC Engine games, and like... There wasn't much to those games. It was pretty much like, here is a standard 8-bit action game that also you don't go from level to level, but you can wander around in the spaces and explore and find stuff. And to me, that's what I really like. That's the thing that speaks to my soul. And if you look at, you know, the really sort of pillars of the genre, the foundations, which would be Super Metroid and Symphony of the Night and really The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past, those are very much like that too. There's a lot of sort of concrete substance, really pretty tightly designed spaces, and a lot of thought about how to take a fairly straightforward action template and then just add a little something extra to it. But games have evolved since then, and the Metroidvania has really evolved a lot in the past decade or so. I feel like Axiom Verge was kind of the last gasp of sort of the true 8-bit Metroidvania game. Even though it wasn't 8-bit, it was very much a love letter to that. And since then, you've had things that people have mentioned, like Hollow Knight, Deedlit and Wonder Labyrinth looks like Symphony of the Night at first, but then you realize, oh, this is something different. There's a lot going on in terms of the genre. What even is a Metroidvania at this point? It's not just people copying Super Metroid's design, which is what you got a lot, 15 years ago, stuff like Guacamelee, which was like, hey, it's Super Metroid, but you have Mexican wrestlers grappling, which, it's kind of fun. That's novel. Shadow Complex, it's Super Metroid, but in Unreal Engine with cover shooting. The Metroidvania is not that anymore. It's diversified. It's expanded. It's gone beyond really where it started out. And it's taken life as, I would say, genuinely like a legitimate genre unto itself, with a great range of content, of style, of difficulty levels, of focuses on platforming over exploration, over combat, like which is what. There's RPG elements in some of them skip that altogether. It's like, to me, it's great. It means I don't have to love every Metroidvania game, because there's so much diversity to it, to the genre, to the style, that there are going to be games that just don't click with me, that don't connect with me. And that's not a failing in myself. It's not a failing in the game. It's just a sign that, it's a broader spectrum of things. It's a huge umbrella now. And I think that's great. As someone who has been advocating for this style of game for a long time now, I love to see how much it's grown beyond where it started. And, even if that means that it's left me behind, I can feel like a proud parent. I helped popularize the name Metroidvania according to Reddit. So therefore, it's like a child leaving home. The Metroidvania is finally ready to go to college, find a career for itself, get out, spread its wings, maybe get married. I don't know. I don't know what the future holds for the Metroidvania, but it's bigger than me now. It's bigger than all of us. And that is okay. I've made my peace with that. That's what this episode was really about, was me coming to terms with the fact that now I am obsolete. And, that's okay. Have fun with your Metroidvanias, kids. There's so many of them, and they're so all over the place. Anyway, that was my obligatory Metroidvania 5-minute speech, or not Metroidvania, Retronauts 5-minute speech. So I'm done. Please share your final thoughts, and then we can wrap this episode.
Oh, final thoughts. I'll have to think of
final. I mean, not final. You'll still be alive once we stop recording. It's okay.
I'm just taking in that monologue you just did, and I'm imagining this future where some young Metroidvania fan enters a castle, and there's like a Jeremy Parrish sitting in a throne saying, "What is a Metroidvania?"
I'm imagining a future where, a Metroidvania comes back home and introduces me to its girlfriend.
Can I try and do a pithy comment, like that really quick rhyming one that we did?
Yeah, please.
Okay, here's my one. It's neat when it's feet, it's shit when it's hit.
It's scary when it's Perry.
You could add that. However, don't.
No, sorry for busting in on your territory.
Yeah, but hey, I don't, I don't come here and say like facts and things, do I? No, in all seriousness, I think that this is a genuinely very, very good game, and I feel a little like Jeremy, not so much in the whole being outmoded thing, because I'm fresh as a daisy, but I mean in the kind of...
I've noticed that smell about you when I've met you in person.
Yeah, that daisies. Is the dirt from the daisies and mm-hmm. the fertilizer. The,
Loamy.
Yeah, thank you. that's kidding me. God damn it. I don't hear that word very often, you know. But I forgot what I was going to say now. Son of a bitch.
Something about being fresh as a daisy?
No, I feel similarly in the sense that there are Metroidvanias that just don't hit for me. And the genre, I mean, to be honest with you, I don't know if I necessarily agree about it having sort of left behind minimalism, because I feel like it's left behind being obscure, I guess, which may be the same sort of thing, but there are still lots of indie Metroidvanias out there that cater for all tastes, like Gato Roboto or Zardion. You know. But nowadays, what you mainly get is, with apologies to The Lost Crown, which I'm again going to obliquely criticize, games that are just copying Hollow Knight. Because Hollow Knight was the new hotness, and it's a very, very good game. I love that game. I mean, it's probably in my top 20 or something, but this game was very much like, hey, that was cool, let's do that. And we're going to get that for a while now. That seems to be how it goes.
But yeah, my point was, in my stirring speech...
It was very stirring.
My point was that there's great variety in Metroidvanias. Not everything is trying to be Hollow Knight. There are still, you know, very old school, very straightforward Metroidvanias, and I can stick with those and be perfectly content and know that there's stuff like this and Silksong out there that are extremely not for me, but people really enjoy them, and I think that's great. And I don't begrudge their existence in any way, and I don't begrudge people who are like, this is the greatest thing I've ever played, because awesome, you've found the thing that you've connected with. And the fact that all of that, you know, falls under like something like Zeo Drifter, which takes about 2 hours to complete and is actually pretty simplistic. Like, the fact that these all fall under the same tent, the Metroidvania tent, like, that's what I'm saying, is that the format has really become a true genre, like a true division of video game design. And I love that. Like, it makes me really sincerely happy. So I'm delighted that I did not enjoy this game at all. Like, genuinely, I'm over the moon about it. I think that's great.
I'm delighted that I got over my complete aversion to messing around with the accessibility options and did so and ended up enjoying myself quite a lot by the end. I might even go back and do 100%. Who knows? You know, being able to just explore the map and do the platform without really having to worry about the combat, that was the ideal for me. And I feel like, unfortunately, the fact that this probably isn't getting a sequel kind of sucks, because I feel like they could have taken on board some of the response they got and they could have made an even more polished game. But to be honest, in reality, it would have probably just been an even bigger game. So I'm,
Hey, did you have any revelations of your own playing this game?
No revelations playing this game. Other than that, I, you know, the things that this game does that I hope end up being in more games, like the whole difficulty setting thing, would be fantastic. You know, the screenshots that you can put in your map, that I imagine will be something that pops up a lot going forward.
Yeah.
In terms of coming to terms with the fact that, as much as I love Metroidvanias, there's always going to be a fairly large number of them that don't appeal to my specific playstyle. Like, I've sort of come to terms with the fact that I will always enjoy reading about the history of the games than playing most of them, probably. For video games in general, to be honest.
Now that I'm a relic myself and a part of history, it's easier for me to stay there. Just enjoy the history. Don't be part of the present.
And are there any books coming out anytime soon that we will be able to read about the history of Metroidvanias in, by any chance?
Well, it's funny you should ask, because March 6th...
Oh my goodness.
The History of Metroidvania, the First Decade, comes out courtesy of Dark Horse Comics. You can find that for pre-order at Barnes & Noble and other bookstores, as well as comic shops.
Well, I'll be
funny you should ask. No, I'm happy with that book. It's relevant to this in a sense, because it is like about the foundational stuff, but it's based on my YouTube series and massively rewritten, expanded, all kinds of new stuff added. And I had like an honest to God like company that does book publishing copy edit it for me and give me feedback. So that was awesome. It's usually just me kind of flying on my own. So it's nice to have the feedback. It'll be good. But why don't we all talk about ourselves in more constructive ways where we can find our own respective works on the internet? Kate, you've done a lot of work with Metroidvania history also. Complimentary yeah. work, I would say.
Yeah, I have. Sorry, I'm. Let me start over. Yeah, I have a YouTube channel, which you can find by searching for Critical Kate. There will be a link to the YouTube where I've done a video about the hidden influences of Metroid, and also I am crossing my fingers that this time there will actually be a video up about the history of the word Metroidvania that I am currently very close to wrapping up.
I did not invent it. Please did, do not yeah. tell your friends that I invented it.
Who invented it? I'll have to wait
That's,
for the video.
We have to see Kate's yeah. video. That's the whole
I bet
point.
It was Prince. He invents all sorts of things.
Prince?
Yeah.
Like the Prince of Persia or the artist formerly known as?
Yeah, but when he was known as Prince, so prior to...
I heard that he recorded a song a day and invented a new word a day, so it's entirely possible.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Kate, where can we find you on social media, if at all?
Oh, just search for Critical Kate, and you'll find my Blue Sky account, probably, which is where I post most of the time.
As you should. Stuart, what about you?
Oh, yes, hello. I'm a games writing man, and also I'm on Retronauts quite a lot. I have a book out called All Games Are Gert. I have another book coming out, which I didn't write 100% of, called Nesbook, which is also hopefully going to be very good when it comes out. I haven't seen the finished thing yet, but I'm sure it will be lovely.
I wrote like 0.5% of that book.
You did. Thank you for that. I appreciate it very much. And I'm also working on a bunch of other stuff that I can't talk about at the moment, but you will hopefully see eventually. And it's all been very exciting and terrifying. And I might be at MAGFest, I guess, this year, next year. So we'll see about that. You know, if you see a big bald guy at MAGFest, you know, there's only going to be me. I'm the only one. So go look for me and give me a big old slap on the back of my bald head.
Please don't. You'll get arrested. It's America.
I'll beat the shit out of you if you do that.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, all over the place, such as here on Retronauts. And God, where else? Oh, yeah, on my YouTube channel, where I haven't really talked that much about the origin of Metroidvania, the word. But I have made videos about Metroidvanias and Metroids and Castlevanias. And let's see. Also, I'm doing work at Limited Run Games, and one of my plans for 2026 is to design a game that will be pretty Metroidvania flavored. Maybe too quaint for people who like, you know, The Lost Crown and Hollow Knight, but for old people like me, it'll be good. A good time. So please look forward to that. Hopefully it'll happen. It'll just depend on what kind of time I have, which isn't that much. I need those special powers that Sargon has. That's the secret. Anyway, you don't need to know where to find Retronauts because you are a Patreon subscriber and we love you for that. Thank you for your support. Hopefully you listened to this episode and thought, you know, that wasn't what I expected, but that was still a damn good investment. That's our goal, is to give you a damn good investment. We are one of the best values in entertainment and we are committed to that. So hopefully this lived up to your dreams and expectations. And if not, well, the good news is that we have another Metroidvania Book Club topic selected. Chris Sims couldn't make it tonight because of complications, but he has tendered the next topic, which is Bloodstained, Ritual of the Night.
Hot diggity
kind
dog.
Of going, yeah. I was hoping we'd get something a little more off the beaten path, but this is pretty much the sequel to Order of Ecclesia, and I guess it makes sense as a follow-up. It's there's been an outcry, an outpouring of demands, so we'll do it. It'll be Bloodstained. I'll lay down the groundwork and the rules in the Discord for how we should talk about it and how far we should go. But I've never actually finished that game. Now that I've completed Order of Ecclesia, I feel like, oh yeah, maybe I should. So I'm looking forward to digging into that one and we'll see where it goes. But that'll be a few months from now. And in the meantime, continue enjoying our podcasts. There's great stuff happening. And remember, as these closing words, parting words, they passed a noble law and the trees are all kept equal by hatchet, axe, and saw.